New England, and of course the ending is just gets very silly. Boris Karloff going around leaving fingerprints glow in the dark, and it's just radiation. I mean, the cover out of space was just not just a little thing like a radiated particle, but it was something from space, and we never know exactly what it was. And then one good thing about that film, of course, is Freda Jackson's marvelous performance of the wife, which is a small role, but she did it very effectively. And Karloff, of course, being Karloff, did a good job of it. I mean, Karloff, of course, Nick Adams, well, he's dead, you don't speak with all the dead, but he's like, well, I'll pass that on. The other films, there was a film called The Crimson Cult, which wasn't scheduled for here. I don't know whether Mr. Kennedy couldn't get it or doesn't even know of its existence, but The Crimson Cult was very loosely based, of course, upon the Dreams in the Witch House. Very, very loosely, because even after you read The Dreams in the Witch House and saw the film, you probably wouldn't recognize that any possible connection. Because in the film, the protagonist goes to visit this house. Christopher Lee is, originally portrayed as sympathetically, because they're trying to make you think that Boris Karloff is a villain. He isn't at all, of course, but it's a red herring. But so one night, in his dream, he discovers a secret passageway that goes up to the attic, and here he sees a whole gathering that the Crimson Cult, you know, and there was the old witch, but it's not the old witch, I mean, not the old crone from the short story, but a beautiful Barbara Steele, you know. After all, no, who wants to pay money to see an old crone? And there's no brown check, and who would believe an rat with a man's face? You know, so it was just the typical people in a satanic cult. And of course, the main significance was the scene where the witch was trying to get him to sign the book. You must sign the book, you know, and he insisted he wasn't going to sign the book, but he had to sign the book. That was about the only real connection. But let's see, what other films? Well, there are other films that are Lovecraft in extent. Kiki, for instance, is very similar to Lovecraft stuff, although he has no real connection. Let's Scare Jessica to Death is quite similar to Lovecraftian stuff, although it has no real connection. And according to Dirk, I've never seen the film, but he saw Dark Intruder, and he insists it's very Lovecraftian, and at least in style and content. And then, of course, there's been an amateur film called The Whispering Darkness, which Dave Smith, you may know of Dave Smith. He wrote a book called The Witch of the Indies, and in great big letters it says, in the tradition of Robert E. Howard, and you see by David C. Smith, it's just like our printed program, about the size of it, poor Dave's name on that cover. But he did that. That was several years ago. He made this amateur version, which lasts not quite an hour, and in two parts, and he didn't know whom to choose for Carl Akeley, so whom did he ask? Jay Vernon. And that's my one and only experience on the screen. Fritz, of course, was in Equinox, which is also quite Lovecraftian. He's the professor with a book that could be the Necronomicon very easily. In fact, I think they purposely tried to make it sound Lovecraftian. Of course, it has no connection really with Lovecraft, but they try to give a Lovecraft significance to it. And let's see, what other films did I skip? What else did I skip? I skipped something else, didn't I? In the films, I mentioned Die, Monster, Die, which was a color out of space, of course, and the alleged Shuttered Room, and the Crimson Cult, and the Dunwich Horror, and the Haunted Cat. I guess I did them all, yes. But Dirk would have to comment on Dark Intruder, because I didn't see the films. I can't comment on a film I didn't see. Dirk, you want to take that over?
Well, the Night Gallery adaptations could also be mentioned. I think the one thing that we can be sure of is that if Lovecraft had lived, he would never have authorized any of those things. We wouldn't have had any Lovecraft films to talk about, which might have been quite fortunate. Professor Burleson, would you like to add something?
Well, I have jotted down here a few rather disjointed and I hope brief comments that don't necessarily have a lot to do with each other, just a few odds and ends I'd like to throw in. One thing I would like to say, while I have the chance, Lovecraft, certainly in my estimation, was and is a great writer. I didn't say a great horror writer, a great fantasy writer. I said a great writer. They've known that because of stylistics and various reasons. They've known that in Europe for years. European criticism is many, many years ahead of our own. But I believe you'll see that American criticism of his works will catch up and corroborate that point of view. Hide and watch. I think you'll see it happen. One thing that we haven't really touched on is Lovecraft's humor. It's sometimes said that, the man, morose figure, you know, didn't seem to have a lot in the way of a sense of humor.
Stephen King has made a crack about that in one of the girly magazines, I think.
Don't believe that for a minute. It's an enormous thing to try to talk about. I'm not about to try to really get into it in any great detail. If you want to see that aspect of Lovecraft, very definitely read his letters, read his stories again in case you missed some things. I can think of things that I caught in Lovecraft stories only on something like the 10th or 12th reading. Just a brief example, in the first paragraph of the novel The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, I'm not going to try to quote it exactly, but something, when he speaks of the disappearance from the hospital, you know, an exceedingly singular person has disappeared from the hospital, he says that person bore the name of Charles Dexter Ward. This is, of course, an instance of what I call ironic foreshadowing, because you don't really know what that's referring to until you've read the whole novel and you go back. I usually, in fact, when I teach my Lovecraft course, I usually recommend that students, when they've read an entire work, whether it be a short story or a novel, in its entirety, go back and reread the first few paragraphs again, and you'll find some remarkable uses of irony there. It's a remarkable little sort of in-joke kinds of foreshadowing. Of course, while we're talking about in-jokes, the list of those is almost endless. So when you start looking at some of the place names, character names, well, some of them, in fact, are fairly well-known. I only recently noticed, for example, that in the Zelia Bishop revision, The Mound, which has a subterranean city called Tsath, a suburb of that city is called Lotha, L'THAA, and phonetically backwards, that is Athol, as in Athol, Massachusetts, where Lovecraft visited W. Paul Cook many times. The man's humor is too large to try to talk about now. It's an aspect of him you shouldn't miss. Vernon Shea mentioned the story Through the Gates of the Silver Key and the mathematical implications there, and reminded me, in fact, that I had meant to comment on that. In a certain passage of that story, Lovecraft talks about intradimensional projection, just as, for example, just as a circle is the projection of a sphere onto two dimensions. If you take a sphere and jam it through the table, what you have in the table is a circle. Okay, you can, of course, analogize that idea to higher dimensions. You can say that a sphere is likewise a projection of some higher dimensional object onto our space, and that object would be a projection from some higher dimensional space, etc., and Lovecraft talks about that as proceeding up to, I think he calls it, the dizzying heights of infinity. And he talks about infinite dimensional archetypal objects, of which all we see is a lower finite dimensional projection. Now, that is handled remarkably well. If you were to hand Lovecraft a page of The Equations, which deal with those things, and say, now here's, you know, this is the kind of partial derivative you have to talk about, and you freeze one of the variables, and this is the way you get the planes to tilt, and so forth, he would probably say, please, my head, you know? Nevertheless, intuitively, that's done remarkably well. It's really worth looking at, you know, carefully. Finally, just let me say, The third point that I threatened to talk about before was the question of whether, and I'll try to be very brief about this because I think it's easy to handle, the question of whether the advancing floodlights of scientific revelation would have perhaps inhibited or impaired the further development of Lovecraft's intentions, specifically, for example, the further development of the Lovecraft mythos. I think the answer to that quite simply is no. I believe, in fact, he would have been more and more encouraged as he went along to do the things he wanted to do. It's pertinent with respect to that point to look at what he thought a weird tale should deal with. He makes it quite clear in a number of his letters that a really cosmic horror story, which is what he did, you know, our colleague who was left down here, Fritz Leiber, of course, has called Lovecraft the literary Copernicus. The really cosmic level weird story, according to Lovecraft, should deal simply with a revolt against or a violation of cosmic order, a suspension or violation of the natural laws of time and space and matter, against which our fancies want to rebel. He's touching a deep chord there. He's saying we would like to break out of the rules of time and space and matter and suspend those and see what happens, if only in a frenzied moment in the mind. So if he had lived to see the further scientific developments of those decades that he should have lived through, I think he would have simply felt that no matter how well understood the universe is, no matter how much we discover about it, no matter how well studied those laws of time and space and matter are, there's still something unknown. Those laws, no matter how well described and delineated, can be suspended, at least in the imagination. And there's certainly, in other words, I don't believe it would be possible to say, well, you know, the advancing floodlight of scientific knowledge will simply push all of that, we'll throw the light on all the dark corners, and we'll simply leave no room to talk about something like the Lovecraftian concept, the cosmicity of the mythos. I believe there always would have been plenty of the unknown left. Lovecraft says, in fact, in one of the last letters of his life, a letter to Fritz Leiber, written on December 19th, 1936, quote, "Nor will science ever be able to kill the feeling of wonder in the human spirit. The mystery of the black outer gulfs and of the deepest cognitive processes within us must always remain unplumbed. And against these, imagination must always frantically pound."
Any questions from the audience?
Yes, there are two points on which I wonder if I could comment. First of all, when Mr. Mozick was speaking about the archetypes, to think about two other great writers of this century, namely John R.R. Tolkien and Franz Kafka. Both are very similar and very dissimilar to Lovecraft. And I wonder if you could speculate a little about their use of archetypes as opposed to the use that Lovecraft was making. I may come back to the other point somewhat later.
I'm afraid that comparing Kafka with Lovecraft is like comparing apples with bananas. It's very difficult to compare them, but you are quite correct. Those two writers are definitely talented expressors of archetypal material. Tolkien, I must confess my sin. I acquired the set of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, or actually novel, and this was when it first appeared in paperback. And I sat down, decided to enjoy it, and after page 80 or so, I just gave up. I just could not read it. It put me to sleep. Now this is my own myopia, bias or whatever.
And I just could not get myself into it. Perhaps what bothered me was the somewhat quasi-optimistic tone. For some quirk of my personality, I prefer a more downbeat type of narrative. I've later looked at Tolkien again, but I've never studied Tolkien. But I get the impression that Tolkien does portray some sort of ethical conflict, good versus evil, and in his work, good triumphs. Lovecraft portrays an indifferent universe where neither good nor evil are meaningful because they are human conceptions. So it would be very difficult to compare them in terms of the use of philosophical concepts or of archetypal material. Of course, in Tolkien, you could pick a number of figures. Wise old man emerges obviously as a very dominant figure, Gandalf. But again, I would feel rather odd trying to make a comparison. Perhaps you would like to add something about the use of archetypes.
The reason I asked this was that Tolkien as well as Lovecraft lived through his childhood without a father figure. Which may have had some impact on his later writings. And I think the question of good versus evil in Tolkien is quite a bit more complicated than just saying that good triumphs in the end, is stated. Well, he has made a discussion of the duty of a heroic man to struggle against evil, even though he may know that the struggle itself is, or maybe futile, in his essay on Beowulf. So I think, well, that's quite another discussion, of course, but I think the question is rather more complicated than saying simply that the good triumphs in the end. On the other hand, well, the reason I mentioned Kafka, well, apart from some rather striking similarities between Kafka and Lovecraft is that, unlike Lovecraft, Kafka had a very dominating father figure lurking over his childhood as well as over his mature years. Also, Kafka is the one writer, apart from Lovecraft, that I know of, who made very conscious use of his dreams for his writings, and somewhat like Lovecraft, he even seemed to regard some of his awakening, some of the things he experienced while awake as a kind of extension of his dream life. Yeah, I think that's sums up the reason I asked this. Okay.
I think you said you had a second a point that you wanted to make, a second question.
While Mr. Joshi was speaking about what would Lovecraft have thought of economic and political developments, I was struck by the thought that he was discussing Lovecraft as if, not completely, but to my mind, as if Lovecraft's ideas were somewhat fixed. I mean, this is the man, this is how he thought, and this then could be how he would have thought if he had lived longer. Well, one of the most fascinating things about Lovecraft, I think, is that he continued to develop intellectually all his life, instead of, like most of us, freezing his intellectual development by the age of 25 or so. It seemed that he always worked over again some of the thoughts that he had expressed earlier and changed them and modified them continuously. So that if one should even discuss what he would have thought about political developments, one surely must take that aspect into consideration. Yeah.
This is undeniably true. In fact, the genesis of Lovecraft's whole philosophical ideas is infinitely fascinating if you read, say, the first volume of Letters and then the last. But certain basic conceptions in Lovecraft's philosophy remain the same. His concept of mechanistic materialism always remained the same. It is evident as early as 1920 in some of his earlier essays and evident in the very end of his life. His aesthetic theories also remained very fixed, if you want to say that, as Professor Mozig outlined his aesthetic theories of writing for self-expression. It is clear that the political and economic ideas would obviously be the most fluctuating of his philosophical beliefs because so many political events were occurring. And when I said that he would have thought of this and that and the other thing after his death, I can do no more than to imagine his reactions based on what he felt at the very end of his life. I have no way of perceiving Lovecraft's mind. Surely he would have been influenced by World War II, his ideas on races and the inferiority of races would have been modified if he had seen what Hitler did to the Jews and many, many other things. But of course, who can say what he would actually have thought? But I think that his ideas on, let us say, communism and fascism, if you want to use that term, I prefer the term aristocracy of intellect, were also relatively fixed, because when fascism emerged in 1923 with Mussolini, he began discussing this very matter in relatively the same terms as he did later on in the 30s. But again, as I say, the idea of what Lovecraft would have thought about almost anything after his death is almost idle speculation. And it's really quite presumptuous of us to even discuss the matter. But as I'm only trying to hint at certain ideas which may be close to the truth or may not be.
Other questions? Yes.
I have one for Gordon, but a movie that is Lovecraftian is The Manitou.
Which one's that?
The Manitou. Oh.
The Manitou? I don't see any. I can't see any. I've seen the film, but I can't see any Lovecraftian connection because. For one thing, computers were, there were computers at the time when Lovecraft was around, but I don't think the computers were used to the extent that they're used today. And I think he would have laughed at the idea that a computer would have a manager or a so-called evil spirit. That would have, because he didn't believe, of course, in the occult at all. And I don't think he would have found anything in that movie that would appeal to him. He saw very few movies because he couldn't afford to. It's about the only time he got to see a film was when he went to New York City to visit Frank Long. And Frank Long, according to his letters, dragged him to a film. But I'm sure he wasn't very much of a drag. He was quite willing to go. But his favorite film, of course, was in his own line of Berkeley Square. That fascinated him completely because it was about a fellow, of course, in modern times who went back into the 18th century, which was his own favorite century. He always wanted to be able to do the same thing himself, although I'm sometimes skeptical about just what would happen if he actually had gone back to the 18th century and had seen the abominable manners and so forth they had used in the 18th century and the lack of scientific knowledge in the 18th century. And the 18th century, I think, he appealed, the writers of the 18th century, of course, appealed to him, but I think if he actually had experienced the 18th century in real life, he would have clamored to come back in a hurry to the 20th century.
Well, Graham Masterson, of course, did develop or borrow Miss Quamacos from the lyric of The Threshold. And I can see why you think it might be a Lovecraftian film because of the cosmic finale, the cosmic battle at the end. But it is, in a way, a ludicrous cosmic battle. Imagine the Manitou of a computer defeating Jörg Sothert.
While we're talking about computers, this may really only be tangentially connected with your question, but perhaps a good time to say this. Probably the proliferation of computer technology is the most striking single thing about modern life. I mean, you just can't turn around without running into some aspect of computerization. And one really wonders what he would have thought of all that. His letters during the latter years of his life are full of impatience or dissatisfaction with what he called the growing age of mechanization, growing machine age culture. He says in a letter to James Morton in October of 1929, quote, I quote this to show that he didn't equate scientific advancement with progress necessarily. The illusion of steady collective progress toward any desired end is a relatively recent origin, and becomes absurd when we reflect that Periclean Greece lies some 2,400 years behind our own essentially mediocre age, unquote. And, you know, typically here you find Lovecraft capable and inclined to look both backwards and forwards in time. It's, I think, not without significance to notice that even his early childhood fascination, scientific fascination with astronomy, was connected intimately with Greco-Roman mythology. And so that, you know, even in the same in the same moment in time, you can, you know, for him, you can look backward and forward in time. He once wrote that the evolving machine age culture is, quote, attuned to the mentality and imagination of the galley slave and the moron, a treadmill squirrel trap culture. So, you know, certainly for all the fascinations that would have come, I don't believe there's any necessary connection, equation by Lovecraft of scientific advancement with progress. I think there would have been a lot of fascination, a lot of satisfaction of curiosity, but I'm not at all inclined to think that he would have been happy with the ubiquitous computer necessarily. You know, the situation where, I'm sorry, we can't check you through to get your groceries because there's something wrong with the machine, you know, and so forth. Basically, you're surrounded by this kind of mechanization everywhere. And I think he would have found that a little melancholy to think about.
Yes.
Dr. Burrell, how much of Lovecraft's providence is left?
I'm happy to report that the bulldozer has been able to get to only a very small part of it. If you read the novel, The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, you will find certain things that are no longer there. Namely, the section, part of the section between South Main and South Water Street, where he talks about the little shipping lanes, little cobblestone shipping lanes with names like doubloon, dime, dollar, cent. When I first visited Providence a number of years ago, most of those were still there. There is still a fragment of the lane, which I believe is named Bullion Lane. But most of that is gone now. There are all kinds of tawdry-looking modern brick buildings there now. But up on the ancient hill, well, let's face it, a very merciful thing is that it's pretty hard to build a 1,000-acre shopping mall on a hill. And you'll find, I believe, most of the ancient hill intact. Golden Ball Inn is not there anymore, that he mentions in the Shunt House, for example. That is a parking lot at the moment. But virtually everything on College Hill is intact. Praise be unto the old ones.
I may just remark on this. I live in Providence. I go to Brown University. And the major reason why so much has been preserved is because the Providence Preservation Society is extremely powerful, and they do not like the destruction of the colonial architecture. In fact, the setting is even better than it was in Lovecraft's time, because all along Benefit Street in Lovecraft's era, the 18th century houses were extremely run down. In fact, Lovecraft called them a slum in the case of Charles Dexter Ward. They've all been restored, and that lane of benefits readism called the greatest single mile of colonial architecture in the United States. So even more than there was in Lovecraft's time is now there.
Still, some of the restoration might have subtracted some of the atmosphere. Yes.
Yes, I'd like to hear from the panel a comparison and contrast of the influence of Lovecraft with that of the two other Musketeers, Weird Tales, Clark Ashton Smith, and Robert E. Howard, as far as their contribution and influence.
Let's see if I understand you correctly. You want to discuss the influence of Lovecraft on Smith and Howard?
No, in comparison.
Compare them. Well, again, there's an apple and bananas comparison. And the comparison would have to be based on the personal bias of the person who's commenting. In this case,
he also mentioned
are you referring to Sprague, the well-known three Musketeers?
On the